What's up, Wildside besties and baddies? I'm Bailey.
And I'm Chelsea, and we're here to walk you through the wild sides.
From homicides to hosticides and everything in between.
We're so glad you're here, so buckle up
and enjoy the ride. Hey, Wildsiders. Welcome, welcome. We're so glad you guys are here. And today we have a really, really awesome interview. We have Dr. Alceste and Lauren Motes. So welcome, you guys. So glad to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yes, I'm very happy to be here too.
Yeah. So if you guys want to just start off and share a little bit about who you are, and so our listeners know exactly who we're talking to today.
Sure. My name is Dr. Fabiana Alceste. I'm an assistant professor of psychology at Butler University in Indianapolis. I got my PhD in psychology from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. And I worked with Dr. Saul Kassin, who is one of the leading false confessions experts in the world. And I am also a false confessions expert. I study police interrogations and confessions. And Lauren is one of my undergraduate students in my research lab.
Yes. Hi. So as Dr. Alceste said, I'm an undergrad student at Butler University. I'm from Noblesville, Indiana, so very close to Butler here in Indianapolis. So I'm a psychology major with minors in sociology and race, gender, and sexuality studies. I've been in Dr. Alceste's lab now for about 2 years. Really enjoy it. It's a great opportunity, I think, for any undergraduate student who wants to make those connections with their professors and to kind of dive into something that they're really interested about and something that I think a lot of people should know more about.
Wow, that's awesome. Hey, Lauren, how far are you from the kids from Stranger Things? Because I'm pretty sure they grew up in Indiana.
I honestly don't know how far away that might be, but I think it's supposed to be like some northern Indiana town, but I haven't seen anyone running around here that looks like 11, so...
I was going to say, have you met them? Have you seen bicycles on the street at all?
There is someone on campus that is like local. She rides her bike around here. She's not a student, but we see this like girl riding her bike around campus all the time. So it's kind of funny that you say that because now that I think about it, there is someone who's always riding their bike on campus.
You're like, so maybe Stranger Things is actually a documentary. Maybe that's a real thing in Indiana.
Yeah.
I think we missed them by a few decades, but you never know.
Yeah, Hawkins.
At the rate that they're growing through the shows, nobody knows. I mean, you're probably right on track.
That's true. Yeah. Hey, Lauren, I have a question for you. Whenever you talk about doing research, of course, I think maybe some people might not think this way, but when I think of research, I think of like sitting behind a computer and doing statistics nonstop. Is that kind of what your research looks like, or... What kind of does that dynamic look like?
So at some points, yes, it's looking kind of at the statistics that we kind of gather from our study. But I think a lot of it is more so hands-on, talking about how we want to run it, how we want to kind of partake in it. And so it's just kind of like discussions with Dr. Alceste and then all my peers in the lab about where do we see this going and kind of what are we learning from it. So it's not so much just kind of like, you know, collecting the data and just like kind of running analyses on it. It's a lot of like, let's talk about what does this mean in terms of what are we trying to like look at? What are we trying to gather from these results? So it's a lot of discussion. Mm-hmm. It's also a lot of kind of review on previous research and such research that is from Saul Kassin that Dr. Alceste has worked with. So that's also kind of what we've done, reviewing the literature. So it's a lot more than just looking at the stats. I think it's a lot of engagement and a lot of let's kind of see where this can go and maybe what can branch off from this.
Yeah, that's great. I did, when I was in college, I did a senior thesis and it was about brain structure. And I remember for a year, I was literally like in a box room comparing brain structures for like a whole year. And I was like, I cannot do this. So both of you ladies for being able to do research, and I know that's probably not exactly what it looks like, I still think that it takes a lot of, I don't know, grit, tenacity to be able to stick to something and not know exactly which direction it's going to take you to really find those results.
Yeah, the research process can be difficult. It can be frustrating. It's very rigorous, and that's what distinguishes science from other types of disciplines. And that's what makes it great. And that's also what makes it really hard to do. So it is a trade-off, but we specialize really in experiments. So we have a lot of control over our variables. We have to be very careful how we define those variables. We, you know, set our analyses up ahead of time, our hypotheses. And it's really a lot of writing is what it is as well, because like you all have figured out, if you don't find a way to communicate your results to other people, then what are you even doing here, right? So a lot of writing and a lot of things like talking to folks like you and trying to get this information out to the public and to other academics as well.
And I love that you said that, Doc, as far as what?
You're just like, I love that, Doc. Thanks.
Doc is fine. Doc sounds great. I love that.
I'm sorry. Is that okay that I call you
Yeah,
Doc?
I think that's great.
You want me to call you Doctor? Like a fancy doctor? I guess that's probably my years of working in the dental field, and you just kind of refer to everybody as, you know, Doc.
Yeah, makes sense.
Well, crap. What was I going to say? Bailey, rude.
Sorry.
You asked a question. So do you guys know that we're sisters?
Oh, I think you mentioned that in your email.
Okay. In case you don't know, we are like biological sisters. No, what I was going to say is, never mind, I lost. Go ahead. All right.
But definitely no like Stanford experiments. None of that.
No Stanford experiments. Everything that we run has to be approved by the Institutional Review Board. And we have very strict ethics that we adhere to. But interestingly that you say that, a lot of, you know, interrogations, research, does involve a little bit of deception. If you are trying to see how someone might falsely confess, that means that you have to accuse someone of something that they didn't do, and they have to believe that you believe that, right? So actually some of our research does involve a little bit of deception. Nothing Stanford level experiment or Stanford experiment level, nothing
sure.
Milgram study level, but yeah, a little bit of ethical deception.
Well, I think it's kind of one of those old sayings, like don't sacrifice a forest for a tree, right? As you kind of looking at the big picture in the long run, the research that you're doing is for a bigger purpose, legally and judicially, socially speaking. And it might take a little bit of that kind of ethical deception, if you will, in order to get the data to implement the changes, even at a bigger macro judicial level.
Yes. And one of the procedures that we have to follow is called debriefing. So at the end of the study, we do tell the participants, hey, just so you know, you're not in trouble. We know that we accused you of something that you did not do, and everything is okay. And here's why we did it. And that's kind of getting at to what you were saying, Bailey. We explain this is why this was necessary, and try to alleviate any feelings of discomfort that are lingering. But most of the time, in my experience, when you start to explain, hey, this is what a false confession is, these are the tactics that we were looking at in this particular study, people really understand. They get it, and they become interested. And now they're invested because they are part of the research, and they understand that. They get that. So that debriefing process is something that is vital to maintaining the relationship between a researcher and their participants.
Okay. Go ahead, Chels.
I was just going to say, like, since that is kind of the meat of this interview is false confessions, obviously, what would you guys, in your experience, what would you guys feel is the biggest misconception that the layperson has about false confessions? Or are there misconceptions? Do people know enough about it to even have a thought on it?
Yeah, there are a lot of misconceptions about interrogations and confessions in general. And I think that makes sense. Interrogations are a pretty private occurrence, and there's not really any reason for the average person to know a lot about the topics that we're going to talk about today. So I think it's really important that we have the opportunity to tell people about this. But maybe the most prevalent and most dangerous misconception might be the notion that an average person would never falsely confess to something that they didn't do, right? It seems so counterintuitive because our instinct is to be protective of ourselves or not do or say anything that's going to incriminate us, even if we actually are guilty of something. But I do think this is improving with the really the explosion of media around wrongful convictions and true crime in general, because these things are helping people become more educated about what interrogations actually do look like, what kinds of tactics are legal and illegal, and they can actually really help attach people's personal stories of a real person that this is something that really happened to in a state that you might have lived in, that you might have been familiar with, connect those personal stories to something as foreign to most people as a criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. But I think that doubt is still present in our minds that we would never falsely confess to something that we didn't do.
And I have to say, you know, one of the, I've learned a lot, even just in the short time that Chelsea and I have been putting together this podcast and interviewing individuals and experts in their fields. You know, 10 years ago, I would say that false confessions are just things that criminals would say to get out of something, right? When you hear people say like, oh, you know, they coerced me, I falsely confessed, my knee-jerk reaction, you know, 5-10 years ago would be like, yeah, okay, guy, sure. But I have to say one of the cases that really, I guess, broadened or opened my aperture around this was the West Memphis 3 case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you guys are familiar with that case. And in a nutshell, they had a big piece of it was they interrogated a high school aged individual who had documented a lower IQ, if you will. And you can listen to this confession. And I mean, he's definitely leading and he says one thing and the interrogator, the officer in charge says, are you sure it was that time? Are you sure it wasn't this time? And, you know, by the end of it, this guy is like, yeah, it was 5 p.m. when, you know, he had an alibi. He had all of these things and then totally confessed to it by the end of this 3 to 6 hour process. And it completely blew my mind.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those kinds of stories are the ones that blow our minds, right? Because if it's just something in general where you're hearing like, oh, a person said that they falsely confessed, I think a lot of people have that misconception as well about like insanity defenses, like pleading not guilty due to reasons of insanity. I think people also are like, okay, sure, like, you know, anything to get out of whatever you think this consequence is. And that is a total misconception, right? So it's really difficult to explain something as emotional as this in a logical way. And I think that's where anecdotes and stories come in, where we have to have the benefit of attaching a story to something that's really difficult to wrap our minds around, because the cold, hard facts of the research is simply not going to be enough to sway lay people and the public. We need to have the stories of the West Memphis 3, the Central Park, the Exonerated 5, all of these stories that now are actually becoming more popular with true crime media, podcasts, documentaries, and that can help to counteract some of the stereotypes that people might have about what happens when someone confesses and why that person might have confessed.
Mm-hmm. As one of like the undergraduate researchers, it was very eye-opening when I first joined the lab, because I had those same feelings of like, I really didn't know what false confessions were. And I kind of, I think, would base it off of like the stereotype, like you said, Bailey. But when I first joined, we kind of did a run through of our experiment, especially for me as a newbie at the time, trying to get a grasp of like how the lab runs and how these experiments would run. And so we did a run through. And so I role played being like a participant. So like another student that would have joined on to participate in our study. And I found myself falsely confessing to whatever it was that we were running in the study. And I never would have thought that I would have done it. But in that moment, it happened, because I, even though I knew it was like a simulation, it wasn't actually something that was like had any high stakes to it. And it was just a run through with my peers. I ended up like falsely confessing because I felt like, you know, I had done something wrong. And in reality, I really didn't do anything wrong. And in reality, nothing ever happened. But it was really shocking to me that that came out of me. And I feel like sometimes it can be a bit of like a personal, like individual thing that maybe some people feel more inclined to just like admit that they're wrong, even though that they're not, in a way of like taking responsibility. And in such a situation where they feel maybe pressured and they're kind of running out of like options and thinking of what can I do in this situation. So for me, that was something that was quite interesting to find myself in that position of, wow, I just kind of like said that I did something when I really didn't do anything wrong and it just came out.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about that, Lauren, is, and I think I shared this with you guys, our listeners definitely know, but I am a licensed professional counselor. I'm a therapist. I specialize in trauma and addiction. And where my brain was going while you were talking about that, what would be some really interesting research behind that is, in the therapy world, when I work with individuals, some people have what I refer to as hyper accountability or hyper responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And at the root of that is it's a trauma response. And a lot of time these individuals, just as you said, they come from a background where taking too much accountability, even on things that they didn't do wrong, it was a survival mechanism for them to be the peacekeeper, for them to say, yes, you're right, I'm sorry, that's my fault. So that way you can stitch up, you know, whatever seam that was torn in this family dynamic, and you can go back to this kind of illusion of normalcy, right, in the family system. And so it's interesting to me from a trauma perspective is, at least for me, like if I had a handful of clients, I could probably tell you just from the little that I know, and I know that I'll learn a lot more from this interview with you guys, but just from what I know and what you shared, I could probably pick out the ones who would be more susceptible to falsely confessing to something when I know their trauma background. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and that's an amazing point, because seriously, like I kind of was sitting here and I was like, oh no, I would falsely confess. And not only would I falsely confess, I would convince myself that it was my fault by the end of it, because that's my personality of just like, guys, it was probably my fault. I'm so sorry. Let me fix it. It's okay. Everything's okay. Everybody's okay. It's okay. We'll fix it and we'll just sweep this and it's my fault. You know, and so I thought that really is, that's an interesting point. But I also was curious, in this research, in this field of false confessions, do you categorize conscious and subconscious, what word am I looking for? Unconscious, sorry. Conscious
or subconscious.
And unconscious, yeah. False confessions. Meaning, like, so I'm going to tell a quick story really quick. My dad called us the other day, and he said, do you remember Grammy going to Disney with us when we were younger? And I was like, no. And he was like, that's so weird, because your mom doesn't remember her. I don't remember her. You don't remember her. Bailey was too little to remember her, but he was in the process of taking old home videos and putting them onto, you know, DVDs. And he was like, Chelsea, I would have passed a lie detector test if someone was like, did your mom, you know, did Grammy go to Disney with you? And he was like, no, absolutely not. And none of us remember her going with us, but she's right there in the video. You know what I mean? So is there categories of conscious false confession and unconscious false confession?
Yes, definitely. We have classified three different kinds of false confessions. The first one is probably the least common, that's probably not true. The first one is what we would call a voluntary false confession. This is like people who want to gain notoriety, you know, for a crime that has gotten a lot of media publicity and attention, and they walk into the police station and they say, that was me, even if it wasn't, right? So voluntary false confession, probably not very common, but you might be able to think of some really prominent examples, historical examples that come to mind. The second one is coerced false confessions, coerced compliant. And those, I think people would agree, are the most common, where you're in an interrogation, the pressure is getting so high, you might be in there for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. You are being accused of something that you didn't do, and suddenly the pressure gets to be too much, and you say, okay, you know what? Fine, I did it. If you say that I did it, fine. You know, I confess to committing this crime. But you know that that is not true. You are saying that to get out of this pressure-filled situation, and you internally have maintained your innocence, even if externally you are falsely confessing. The third one is the one that I think is closest to what Chelsea is talking about, which is internalized false confession. And so that is where people actually start to make up a memory of themselves committing this crime. And a lot of times that happens with young folks. It happens with people who have developmental or intellectual disabilities. And most of all, it can happen with average people as well, average adults, when the presentation of false evidence is a tactic that is used during the interrogation. So if someone is credibly telling you, we have evidence that you committed this crime, and also pairing that with something like, you know, sometimes when traumatic things happen, our brains block it out, and it's very possible that you did this whole thing, you committed this whole sequence of events, and you just don't remember, and we have your fingerprints on the gun. And you're like, well, how is that possible, right? So that presentation of false evidence, they're allowed to say things like that, that they have your fingerprints, they have video surveillance footage of you committing the crime, there's an eyewitness who placed you at the scene of the crime, et cetera, even if that is not true. And so when you credibly misrepresent reality to people like that, sometimes it unmoors them. It really causes them to question their own beliefs and their own memories. And then you pair it with this explanation of, oh, this happens all the time. It's possible that you were just so traumatized that you don't remember. That's where people can really start to falsely create a memory that never actually happened. And that is pretty rare. And the memories are usually very short-lived. So it's not like the person lives the rest of their life with this false memory. But it's just long enough for you to give a confession that sounds really convincing and perhaps get convicted on the basis of that confession.
Ugh, that's so scary. But that's just kind of terrifying if you think about it, because I know enough to, you know, just from being a true crime connoisseur, if you will, from watching enough shows and all of this, and I know it's not always accurate, but about being able to be dishonest in interrogations, tell individuals that they do have evidence when in fact they don't, right? Kind of, for lack of better words, any means necessary to get a confession, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, Dr. A, is there, you mentioned it earlier as far as the coerced confessions, is there kind of a correlation from the data and the research between IQ and the probability that someone would make a false confession?
There are definitely different characteristics that can put a person at risk for being induced to falsely confess. And having an intellectual or a developmental disability is certainly at the top of that list. Different kinds of disabilities can make people vulnerable in the interrogation room for different reasons. So if someone has impaired social or cognitive skills, or doesn't understand their rights, or even the stakes of the situation that they're in, or if they have trouble coping with the really intense psychological pressure of an interrogation, then that can obviously lead them to make uninformed decisions, like maybe waiving their Miranda rights and not realizing that they're free to leave and then complying with the interrogator. But aside from those kinds of disabilities, there are other factors that could still make someone increasingly vulnerable to a false confession, like you mentioned, their history of trauma, their mental health, and obviously their age. So young suspects are one of the most vulnerable groups to give a false or coerced confession. Just because of the characteristics that come with not having a fully developed brain, fully developed social and cognitive skills. So young people can be especially susceptible to suggestion, meaning that they fall prey to things like leading questions and that interrogational pressure. And they're also more likely to comply with authority figures just based on the really prevalent social norm that young people are supposed to listen to and obey adults, especially adults with power, like law enforcement officers. So yes, intelligence is one of the characteristics that is associated with people that we know have given false confessions, but it also goes a lot further than that as well.
You know, I substitute teach, and I've substitute taught for, I think, going on 4 years now, and I've done like long-term subs, you know, like, so essentially I've been in the school systems for a while. And when you were talking about this, it made me think of, we had a situation last year with a fifth grader, and there were some derogatory things that were written on a piece of paper on the playground, you know, one of those types of things. And the kid, one of the kids that was involved, was your stereotypical, like, if a kid is going to get in trouble, it's going to be this kid, right? And I remember, you know, these other kids were like, oh, it was this kid who did it. And so we bring the kid over, and the kid's like, I didn't do it, you know? And it was myself and another teacher, and we were like, buddy, you know, it's okay if you did it. You just need to let us know so that we can handle this. And I remember that our third teacher that was in our group, she was like, look, he said he didn't do it. At this point, you guys are just kind of like pushing him like to say he did. Because we were like, it's okay. It's not going to be that big of a deal. Just let us know. Because again, our history with this kid was, you know, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and all these things. But that has been so impactful to me, and especially kind of hearing about you guys, where I'm like, how often is our society, is us as mentors or parents or adults, kind of training kids to, like, you know what, if you're that person, you probably did something wrong, so just go ahead and confess to it.
And it's so funny that you mention, I'll use a word that you disagree with here, but the tactics that you were using to get this kid to...
Yes, and so unknowingly. Like, I really was not trying, because it was just one of those, like, buddy, if you don't, then we're going to have to take it to the principal. Like, if you just go ahead and confess, we can take care of it right here. But again, when it was brought to light, I was like, oh my goodness, I am being very manipulative with this guy. You know, and it was like,
and unintentionally so, right?
Right. And it was humbling. And I was just like, if someone would ask me, would you do that to a person? Would you manipulate a child? I would say, absolutely not. I would never do that. But again, I wasn't trying to be malicious, right? In my mind, I was like, I was trying to help him. But what I was really doing was, he was telling me an answer, and I was telling him, that's not right. The right answer. I need a different answer so we can move on.
And what's so funny, Chelsea, is that you have just now intuited the main interrogation technique in the United States, a technique called minimization, which is pervasive in the United States. And it's really funny that that was the technique that you gravitated towards, because it's one that on the outside looks, it doesn't look manipulative, and it doesn't look like what you would imagine an interrogation to look like. You're not cursing at him. You're not threatening him, right? You're telling him it's going to be okay. It's not that big of a deal. You know, I understand why you may have done something like this. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person or a bad kid. And all of those tactics, there's literally books of tactics that are aimed at minimizing the moral seriousness of the offense.
Wow.
And what we know from psychological research is that what that communicates to people is that if they confess, they will get a lower sentence, or they will be punished less severely than if they don't confess. And it works on innocent people as well.
Yes. And that is, like I said, it was the most, like, I just was shook by this realization of, like, am I that person? Because it's like, I love these kids so much. And that's why I'm there. And that's why I show up. And that's why, and I love our educators, and I want to be that person, right? All of these things. But I did that. I did it. And I didn't plan on, you know, it was. So again, I just feel like it's so important what you guys are doing, because, and I think it's so important for people to hear these things and what this looks like and how this, because again, if you were just point blank asked me that question, would you do that? I would, from the bottom of my heart, say absolutely not. I would never manipulate. I would never do that to an innocent, especially a child.
Right.
But you do.
Chelsea, it's,
you do it.
It's very interesting you say that about your realization, because I also, like, sitting here thinking about my summer job, I'm a manager at a pool back home. And so a couple of times there's been incidents where I've had to step outside the office and go and talk to kids on the pool deck that my guards have reported to me that are acting inappropriately. They're picking on other kids. And when you say that, I'm like thinking back, like, am I also using that? Am I trying to kind of approach it in that direction, but in potentially leading them to say something that they did, but they actually never did? And so it's, I think, something that it slips in and out that we just don't realize sometimes. And like you said, we approach it in a way that we think is okay, but in reality, it could turn out to be something that's wrong and it's not the right way. And it's so hard not knowing that in the moment, and now thinking about it now, you're like, man, like, I wish I could have, you know, said that a different way, approached it differently, you know, instead of maybe making that kid feel targeted and feel small, and that he has it, he or she has nowhere else to kind of like go, and that they have to say something to just like give you something to go along with and just be like, yeah, I did this, even though they didn't.
Yeah.
And I think the difference between, you know, Chelsea, what you're describing and this exact technique being used as a police interrogation tactic is that perhaps if the kid had confessed, you could have had some say in the consequence for that kid, right? You could have gone to the principal and said, look, he said that he did it, but I don't think that he's a bad kid. He made a mistake, etc. And you might actually have kind of a hand in what the consequences for that kid might be. But the police are using this purely as a tactic. They do not have say over what you get charged with. They do not have say over what your sentence is going to be. So that is a manipulative tactic that does communicate leniency to people, leniency that is not forthcoming at all, and that the police do not have the power to promise. But those implicit promises are still communicated to them and do lead to the decision-making process of, okay, I'll say that I did it so that this is easier for me.
You know, and what comes to mind as I'm hearing this is, again, you know, putting my stuff out there and maybe hopefully how much I've grown over the past few years. But, you know, again, if you would have asked me 10 years ago, I would have believed these, you know, stereotypical things that you hear in police interviews and documentaries. You know, I hear a lot of like, well, innocent people do X, Y, and Z, and guilty people do X, Y, and Z. And one of the things that I hear all the time, kind of in this vein, is if you're innocent, why would you not take a polygraph, right? You're judged, you are looked as a guilty person if you choose not to do a polygraph, even though they can't use polygraphs in court, right? Even though it means kind of nothing. And my husband, who he was in law enforcement for many years, one of the things that we talk about, you know, whenever we're on this topic, is he says, Bailey, if for whatever reason, right, you're speeding too fast in a traffic zone and you get arrested or whatever the case is, he was like, do not open your mouth until you ask for an attorney. And he said this, he's emphatic about this. And I was like, well, then they're going to think I'm guilty, but I'm not guilty. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. He was like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He was like, you don't know the legal system. You're not an attorney. Like, you don't know what is going to be coming down the pike. You need appropriate representation to help guide you through that process. And so I guess I say all of that to kind of lead into this question of, does that make it even more important to have appropriate legal counsel and representation in the interrogation process?
Definitely. I mean, I think that's something that is a pervasive, almost stereotype here, that innocent people don't have anything to hide, so they don't need lawyers, or that guilty people will clam up as soon as they know that they're under suspicion of a crime. But actually, the truth is that innocent and guilty people, as we've studied them in the lab, waive their rights at similar rates. And we know from field studies of real interrogations that obviously we don't know if these people are innocent or guilty because these are real crimes that have been committed, that almost everyone ends up waiving their Miranda rights. Extremely, extremely high rates of people waiving their Miranda rights. And so this notion that an innocent person is going to want to help and an innocent person is not going to have anything to hide, at the end of the day, I think, like your husband said, it doesn't matter. The biggest problem is that if for any reason an interrogator starts to believe that you are guilty, we know that that can begin a process of what we call behavioral confirmation or confirmation bias, where they start to question you a little bit more aggressively, you start to get a little bit more defensive, and then that makes you look even guiltier. And so that feedback loop just continues and continues until eventually there might be a false confession. And actually, research has shown that when a person is being interrogated by a person that thinks they are guilty, it makes other people think that they're guilty as well, even if they are innocent. So it does set into motion this process of behavioral confirmation, where you start to act in a way that confirms, in kind of an illusory way, the original thought about you being guilty, even if you are innocent.
I, Dr. A and Dr. K, y'all are on our crap list now. I just want you to know, Dr. K ruined science for us.
And you too, Lauren, you too for being in that lab.
By association, y'all are on our crap list because Dr. K ruined science for us. You're ruining patriotism and being a good human being, because and so now I'm just like pointing to all the people that I've heard in my life, whether, you know, personally I knew them or, you know, on media or whatever, and they're like, if you're just a good person, you do the right thing, cops aren't gonna mess with you. And I used to 1000% believe that. You know, cops don't pick fights. Cops don't do this stuff. You know, police interrogators, investigators, they're these super hyper aligned moral entities walking around doing, you know, the hard work that nobody wants to do. And while I still respect that and believe that to an extent, this is like, this is a whole nother, it doesn't matter, right? Because what I'm hearing you say is you could be like, I'm picturing myself, right? I consider myself to be a kind, loving, warm person. I'm a trauma therapist, for crying out loud. I help people through their trauma. Okay? Chels, did you?
I was going to say that's true. Continue.
Thank you. And if I got arrested and they knew that I was a therapist, can you imagine, and I'm just looking for confirmation from you, Dr. A, that they would be like, well, of course you know what to say, you're a therapist. You're obviously being...
Like, do they think that you know how to manipulate them?
Right, like they would be like, oh, well, you know, you're probably saying this, that, and the other because you know psychology, you're a therapist, so you're... Like, based off of what you said about a confirmation bias, if they believed I was guilty, then they would weaponize whatever they needed to confirm that bias that they had from when I walked through the door. Does that make sense?
It does, but I think a really important thing to keep in mind is that this kind of bias, like, obviously there are, I think the vast majority of interrogators and detectives and law enforcement are just people who are trying to do their job given the training that they have received. And I think it's a mistake to now change our worldview and think that, you know, law enforcement are malicious and are weaponizing information that they have. I don't think that that's the case most of the time. I think the problem is with the training that they have received and this notion that, well, if you're a police officer, everyone is going to try to lie to you and everyone is going to be against you. And therefore, that is the perspective that you need to take when you're investigating these crimes. I think that more than anything, the perspective that is being trained into this field and the lack of adherence to psychological research and the adoption of what psychological results have shown us, I think that more than any individual notion of you're weaponizing information or you're, this is an immoral thing, I think the problem is not with law enforcement. The problem is with what law enforcement are being taught, because at the end of the day, they're just doing the best that they can with the training that they have received. And the training is really the thing that ends up being the problem. If they had better ways to do things, if they had a more psychologically rich understanding of an interaction, for example, between you allegedly speeding and the person that pulls you over, they might not go straight to that bias. They might be able to stop and think and not have that automatic bias take over. But that is not what police officers are encouraged to do right now.
Yeah. And as like the other peers in my research lab, Dr. Alceste has kind of shown us and taught us a little bit about these techniques and tactics that law enforcement has used. And we kind of learned this in the very beginning of my days in the lab. And it was quite interesting to see it all play out. And you kind of just sit there and you're like, is this kind of really what they're doing? Is this really how they're going to try and get information out of us? Because we're sitting there as a group of undergrads watching and learning about this. And we're kind of like, huh, so this is what they think is the best way to approach this. And so when Dr. Alceste is saying that a lot of it is coming from that training that needs to be looked at and needs to take a closer look of how can we maybe revise this, or how can we understand where this training is going wrong in a sense of leading to these false confessions, leading to these innocent people waiving their rights when really they don't need to. And it's just kind of, you know, like she said, it's not, we don't want to portray law enforcement as malicious. We don't want them to come across in that light. We want to look at the behind the scenes of what are they learning and what are they grasping and then thus enforcing. And so it's a very eye-opening experience. And it's like, it's just very interesting to know. And now having that information, you kind of think about things differently and you kind of, you see the world in a bit of a different light, not so much a negative light, but just you see so much more.
Now, does your program, department, college, whatever your field, I guess I could maybe even say, are you guys involved in essentially writing up courses or writing up training that is trying to be adopted by law enforcement? And my thought on that, so I'm in school currently. I was a dental hygienist. I graduated in 2007, right? So I've been doing it a long time, but not as long as some, longer than others type of thing. But it is blowing my mind being back in school and talking about things like cultural competency. We didn't talk about cultural competency in 2007, right? That was not something that was on our radar. And now it's like, it is so important to get to understand the culture of a person, and not just their age or their gender or their sex or, you know, nationality, but like their culture, because that is really going to impact how you treat this person, treat as in like, you know, their treatment plan. And so again, and it's probably because I am in school right now, but just hearing all of this where it's like, is it a lot of just outdated information? Is it a lot of ignorance that needs to be updated as far as interrogation and understanding false confessions? And do you guys have programs that you're trying to write so that we can be a better society, essentially?
Yeah, so absolutely. A lot of what's going on right now and what is continuing to be taught is based off of a lot of intuition of people that have been doing this for 50 years, and they were taught by someone who had done it for 30 years, and they are now teaching the newer folks that are, and well, you know, Officer John has always done it this way and he's gotten confessions, and so there's nothing wrong with the system and we just need to keep going the way that it is. And what that does not account for is the advancements that, you know, the psychology of false confessions is a relatively new field. Interrogations and confessions have been around a lot longer than any single research study on this topic. And so it's a mistake to not adopt all of the information that we have gathered since we have started studying this topic with the scientific method in a more rigorous way than this is the way that we've always done it, right? And one of the most important things that can help us merge some of our the experience of practitioners and the knowledge of academics is to build relationships across these two fields. Because right now, I think that a lot of people on either side think of the other side as adversaries or as enemies, and we're pointing fingers. Well, you're doing this wrong. Okay, well, you can't tell me what to do because you are not in this this career. And so I think that one of the most important things is to build that trust and build the relationship, because it can be really easy to forget that we all have the same goal here, right? The goal is to get true confessions out of guilty people and not false confessions out of innocent people. And everyone agrees that that is what we should be doing. We just don't agree about how we go about doing that. And so we need to build that trust. We need to get practitioners invested in the psychology of false confessions and interrogations. And we need to get academics invested in how difficult it is to be a law enforcement officer and how this is an impossible situation to be in. And by doing that, and we have started to do that to some extent. So no, we are not, I am not leading trainings. Maybe there are other people in this field that are, you know, and we are invited to law enforcement conferences, and we do have the ability to get up in front of an audience of law enforcement and give them the results of our research. And I think that's an excellent start, but we need to go a little bit deeper and really build those relationships so that we can start working together.
Dr. A, if you, I don't know if this is something that A, you would be interested in, B, if you have time for, but Chelsea and I did an interview with a wonderful human being. His name is Dr. Everett Penn, and he is the embedded criminologist in the Houston Police Department. And he created a program that's called TAPS, and that stands for the Teen and Police Service Academy. And he's doing a lot with what you just said, is really trying to marry the very different, arguably historically different subsets of people, which was cops and youth, right? Our youth, especially minority youth. And I, what my brain was saying is, I imagine that he would be so open to speaking to you about your expertise in false confessions, in allowing some sort of education, especially for his program, not only to educate the law enforcement officers that is a part of his team, but also the youth of the risks of, you know, interrogative, mm-hmm. is that a word?
Yeah.
Interrogative processes and pressures that would coexist. So I don't know if you're interested in that, but if you were open to it, I could always send him your information, because he is a huge advocate for multidisciplinary work.
Yeah, that would be great. And I know of psychologists and, you know, academics that specifically study adolescents and, you know, youth in general, which is not really my specialization, but yeah, I'd be interested in contacting him and also seeing if people with a more youth-focused research specialty could also help as well. I think that would be great.
Cool. I don't mean to, like, you know, shift you guys out to each other, but
actually we've already sent the email out. Sorry, Dr. A. We've already sent it out.
No, yeah, I think that it's great. These are the kinds of connections that we need to be making. So,
and I feel like, you know, we, as hosts at a podcast, we're not going to make any major reform or reformations from a macro level, but we meet these really powerful, brilliant, wonderful people like you guys, and we get a really unique vantage point because we're saying, oh, we interviewed this person who specializes in this, and this has like a Venn diagram overlap of this person who does this. And I wonder what would happen if these forces came together. And so it's just me kind of brainstorming over here on my end.
Yeah, I think that's excellent.
So for both of you ladies, do you feel that things as simple as funding is one of your major barriers on getting more results?
doing more research? Or is this a pretty well-funded department, field, program?
I think that, I mean, no one is ever going to say no to more funding. So I think that everyone could use more resources, more funding. But we do have a lot of data. We have data. We have access to populations. Another really important thing that building a relationship with practitioners is that we can do research with them, right? We can take surveys of what their experiences have been, because that's really the piece that we are lacking as researchers, right? We need to be able to have information about the experiences that they have so that we can then better tailor our experiments to what they are doing and then see if they work, right? See how they work, see the psychological mechanisms behind them. So I think in terms of resources, we already are doing a lot of work. Probably the biggest obstacle is the communication of the research that is being done. And getting people to change their minds about something that they have not had to critique for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
So I would say more than anything, that is probably one of the barriers.
With you being a student and working in the lab and having peers, I'm going to make an assumption, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds, Lauren, like you are very open-minded and you were like, oh, I was amazed that I did that. That was, you know, I really was able to learn from that. And it made me think of when I work at, you know, my place back home. And do you find that a lot of the undergraduates that you work with are as open-minded, kind of where, like Dr. A was saying, is just like, is it, how easy or how hard is it for you guys to have an open mind with something that is maybe counterintuitive?
That's a great question, because I've thought a lot about this throughout kind of my experience in the lab and just kind of my undergrad experience in general. You know, we all go off to college and we all come from different backgrounds, different upbringings, different cultures, and just the different ways in which, you know, whether or not our perspectives of the world, our perspectives on society, how much of that is influenced by our family, by our parents, by our peers' home. And so I think, you know, depending on that, but the lab and the research in general, and so far my education here, I think I've learned to be more open-minded. And I think this has really propelled that mindset forward, because, you know, I picked up the race and gender and sexuality study minor just last semester because, you know, I'm learning more and more about the kind of social injustices that we see within society, you know, through the lab, but also through the courses I am taking. And so I've worked on being more open-minded as I've gotten older and trying to hear out each side to every story, just learn more about the different perspectives on certain situations, because I think in order to get a full grasp and full understanding of what's going on, you need to hear both sides out. And so definitely with the research that we've done and being in the lab setting, working with Dr. Alceste and working with peers who are, you know, either have been in the lab as long as me or new additions who were kind of, you know, showing them how it goes and, you know, building those relationships. I think being open-minded to what they have to say, especially, is very important. And then taking into account what it is that we're kind of learning here and spreading awareness about, you know, what we've been talking about, because I think, you know, it's very important to kind of talk about these things. It's very important to provide multiple perspectives, multiple sides of the story, because I think being closed-minded and not really knowing everything, I think you're kind of missing out and you're not getting the full picture. And so, so being open-minded is something I've definitely have been working on. And so far working with Dr. Alceste, it's been really great. And so she's helped me a lot, kind of, I think, in that sense of becoming a better student and a better researcher and learning to kind of explore things and see things in a different light than maybe what I would have seen a couple of years ago as a whole other person, a freshman in college. So, yeah.
I love that.
Well, and from what you guys have talked about, I mean, really,
it's as major as putting people's quality of life at stake. Okay. You know, like if we are not willing to say, yeah, you might be manipulative, or you might be a person who could false confess, or this is something that happens, like not having the ability to accept that that could be an issue, not having the information or the education. Like I said, it could, without being sounding dramatic, I mean, it really could put somebody's life or quality of life at least at stake.
Yeah.
And I know that we're closing in on our time. Do I have time for one more question, or do we need to cut this here and say our goodbyes?
I do have another meeting with students, but I told them that I might be late. So I think that we have time for another question.
Okay. One last question, and we can make it short and sweet, is once somebody might have succumbed to a false confession, they confessed falsely. How difficult is the process for that to kind of untie, right? Somebody confesses to something, they didn't do it, they're arrested, and then, you know, they get away from the stressful situation, they get a good night's rest, they get some food, they get hydrated, and they're like, oh crap, you know, I made a confession and I didn't mean it, or they really understand the impact of, you know, what they did. How is that process? I mean, can it be reversed? Can it be undone?
Once a confession enters into evidence, it is extremely hard to expunge that. So technically, defense attorneys have the right to request a hearing for the confession to be excluded as evidence if it was involuntary or if it was taken improperly, like if Miranda warnings weren't read when they should have been. But it's actually pretty rare for a judge to agree that something like that happened and for them to rule to exclude a confession from a case.
Wow.
And a lot of times, once someone confesses, the investigation effectively stops. Why would they keep investigating if they think that they found the true perpetrator and that the person confessed to the crime? So there's little chance of someone now uncovering new information that contradicts the confession to the extent that this new piece of evidence would be believed over that confession. And we know a lot from, you know, Dr. K probably talked a lot about this when you interviewed him, but we know from research with forensic experts and medical examiners that a confession can actually taint these kinds of professionals' examination of forensic evidence, like fingerprints, autopsies, handwriting evidence, things like that. So once a forensic expert knows that a suspect has confessed, they are now more likely to judge that forensic evidence as a match to that suspect, even if they're actually pretty dissimilar. And confessions can do this with other types of evidence, like alibi witnesses can change their stories. It can change the minds of eyewitnesses who had originally excluded the suspect as the perpetrator. So in other words, once a confession enters the scene, it can effectively change the entire case. And bit by bit by bit, the confession taints other pieces of evidence, which should be totally independent of each other. All of these pieces of evidence should be analyzed separately.
But we're human.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a very human way to form patterns. And this is it's a bias that is really easy to come into play. And has nothing to do with morality. It has nothing to do with laziness. It has everything to do with just this is the way that our brains interpret information, right? Mm-hmm. So even though all of these pieces of evidence should independently point to the perpetrator and independently be analyzed separately, a confession can influence all of these other things and make them look like they're all pointing to one suspect, even if they don't. And we actually have a name for this. This is called corroboration inflation. It seems like all these pieces of evidence corroborate each other, but it's really just an illusion that is propped up by the confession.
And on that note, thank you for tuning in. This is where we conclude our episode.
on that happy note.
Well, Dr. A, Lauren, you guys are rock stars. You are the bomb.com. We really appreciate you.
All that and a bag of chips, a big bag of chips.
Not the half full with air one, like the full packed bag of chips. But we really, really appreciate you guys for sharing your time and your expertise with us. And I just am so impressed by the work that you guys do. And thank you very, very much for agreeing to come on here at The Wild Side.
Of course. Thank you both. And let us know if there's anything else you need
from
us.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's just so inspirational. And I think inspirational is the word that I'm going to, that's the word I'm going to use. And I said what I said, and I'm inspired. I don't know. I don't even know what to do with my hands. Like, y'all are amazing.
Dr. A, thank you. Lauren, thank you. And get to your meeting with your kiddos and tell them that you are the bomb.com. Wild Side said so.
Of course. Thank you. And yeah, like I said, don't hesitate to reach out.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye, ladies.
Hey, Wildside Tribe, don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Wildside Podcast. Make sure to tune in on Wildside Wednesdays. New episodes will drop each Wednesday at 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We would love to hear from you, so if you have a wild case recommendation, email us at wildsidepodcast@gmail.com. That's Wildside with a C. Or share your thoughts in the comments below. As always, if you haven't heard it today, you're loved, you're worthy, and you're valuable. And we'll catch you on
the flip side.